Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kari Hong. I'm from the Florence Project. I'm appointed pro bono counsel for petitioner Uday Rudan. I will reserve 3 minutes and I will watch my time. I will talk about acquiescence, the death threat, and relocation. On acquiescence, Mr. Rudan reported to the police that his son, Uday Allen, had hired a hitman named Gelvin Gongora to kill him. The BIA and IJ found no acquiescence on the mistaken belief that the police did not protect him because his sister did not cooperate with the police. That misses the point. The question is not whether the police will open an investigation. The legal question is whether the police will complete one. And on this record, they can't. Acquiescence has two parts. The first, the police must be aware of the torture before it occurs. And second, the police do not intervene because they are unwilling or unable to do so. The first element is met. Mr. Rudan, the victim, reported the assassination plot to the police. For purposes of acquiescence, the police know about the plan. On the second element, this record has enough evidence for us to conclude that Allen and Gongora should be prosecuted for at least 3 attempted murders of a police officer, a security guard, and a man that they all shot. All crimes are detailed in newspapers and on a videotape. The Belizean police haven't punished these men. And in fact, they keep releasing them after arresting them without conviction or punishment. These are specific circumstances unique to Mr. Rudan to establish that the police are unable and unwilling to punish the same men who want to kill him.
That raises a question of what is the scope of the government, because the police do the arrest, as you've already outlined here, but then the record suggests that the prosecution drops charges or doesn't go forward, which is not necessarily the police, but it is the government. And ostensibly because of either uncooperative witnesses or weak evidence. So how are we to evaluate that in terms of acquiescence?
Madrigal says only one officer that acquiesces, one government official that acquiesces meets the acquiescence standard. And so Zochia Jaimes is very instructive because there was evidence that the national government was actually trying to stop the cartels. But even Zochia Jaimes said, we have to look below that surface. On that record, the local police were corrupt. So that then undermined and offset the national policies that would have been enough. And both Zochia and Madrigal are instructive because they're, as you pointed out, the general ineffectiveness of police will not be enough to meet acquiescence, but also a national policy showing willingness isn't enough. Rather, the test by these cases is that an applicant has to show two things: personal or specific circumstances establishing acquiescence, and country condition evidence documenting a widespread problem. Mr. Rudan meets those tests. He presented general country conditions documenting how the Belizean government and police are pursuing policies that the Prime Minister, Johnny Briceño, laments is making the gang violence worse. And then for personal circumstances, we have a very unique record, an extraordinary pattern of the Belizean police being unable to convict and imprison two men they know are attempted murder. We have wanted posters. We have a police commissioner telling the press that the police, quote, have been unable to find Allen and Gongora. And these are the same two men who want to kill Mr. Rudan. Evidence of personal circumstances is met.
So, because you're really pointing to the wanted posters and the news articles as the record that you think the agency overlooked that could be highly probative or potentially dispositive. So I guess, how would they change the agency's reasoning here?
Well, and Your Honor, one other factor, too, is that they keep releasing, they arrest these guys and then they release them. So even when they're apprehended, they are released without conviction or punishment. So that's a key fact as well. But to your question, this would have changed the analysis because the government or the BIA in a footnote only mentioned that there are general country conditions of generalized violence. And that is not at all relevant to the acquiescence standards, which details specific circumstances to Mr. Rudan to show that the police are unable to protect him. So the remedy would be the De Villa v. Barr, where remand is required when the agency has only selective reliance on country conditions and doesn't look at the entire record.
And the reference to generally looking is not enough?
No, because acquiescence requires specific circumstances. I mean, we have four good acquiescence cases, two where there was acquiescence found in Madrigal and Xochitl Jaimes, and two where they weren't, which is Garcia Millan and Andrade Garcia. All four say that there has to be evidence, a specific circumstance of acquiescence. And that is what Mr. Rudan had, which is what the agency never even acknowledged. On the death threat, under Carpeno Romero, not all death threats are hollow. A death threat will rise to persecution or torture when the group making it, one, has the will, and two, has the ability to carry it out. The BIA and IJ did not follow this rule. The IJ claimed there was no risk of torture because the son never directly communicated the death threat to him. Now, the BIA didn't affirm that reasoning. Instead, the BIA found that the IJ permissibly discounted the testimony because it was hearsay. Now, putting aside that the BIA can't make new findings on appeal, both reasons are wrong. The IJ is wrong because there is no rule saying that death threats that are directly communicated to the victim are the ones that count. The government conceded as much in its briefing, and in Cup v. Ashcroft, indirect death threats can be more threatening because they terrorize the victim. Now, second, the BIA is wrong because hearsay is admitted in immigration court unless there is an objection and if there is evidence that casts doubt on its accuracy. The DHS never asserted there was any reason to doubt the existence of the death threat at the hearing or on appeal. And under Hernandez v. Garland, when the federal rules of evidence do not apply and hearsay is excluded only when the opposing party makes a showing that the information is incorrect. Now, the real test for death threats is whether the threat is made by people who have the capacity to carry it out. And under Carpeno Romero, a person does not have to wait for the outcome to be realized. Rather, if the threat is specific, menacing, and credible, that will be enough for torture. On Will, Allen made a specific death threat to kill his father over a grudge. Like Carpeno Romero, the killer knows who Mr. Rudan is, how to find him, and is motivated to do so. And on capacity, there is every reason to believe that Allen will kill his father. Allen has killed 15 people. Newspaper articles show he tried to kill two other men, and Kelvin Gagora, the hitman, is on a videotape shooting at a third man. Under Duran Rodriguez, a death threat will be past torture when it is menacing and causes actual harm. Mr. Rudan's documented PTSD from this death threat independently proves past torture. The Dr. Tyson report confirms the serious and ongoing symptoms of PTSD arising from his son's assassination threat. Under Carpeno Romero, the continuing harm from the death threat is established through lasting harm through the PTSD. And now these facts comport with the Colmenares observation that the anticipation of assassination by hitman can be a source of mental anguish to qualify for protection under 208.18a4. On relocation, under 1208.16, a fact finder must consider all evidence relevant to the possibility of future torture. the BIA and the IJ's relocation analysis never considered the existence of a credible death threat and never considered that the police are unable to protect Mr. Rudan from his son. The analysis must be redone with the correct facts. Under De Leon, this court remanded that error for the agency to do it again. Under Zachia Jaimes, this court found that the applicant qualified for CAT based on that location. The court here has the authority to follow either of those remedies.
Did the agency put the burden on the petitioner to prove or to present evidence on relocation?
Your Honor, my reading of the record is that they attempted to prove that it was impossible under Maldonado. They cited Maldonado and then applied the wrong standard. But for present purposes, I think a cleaner way to resolve this is simply that they never acknowledged that there was a credible death threat, and they never acknowledged the ample evidence that the police are unable to protect.
Who brought up relocation to begin with?
Well, it is his burden, even under Maldonado. Yes. It's his burden to prove as an applicant. But under Maldonado, the regulations require the fact finder to consider all evidence.
Yes.
And so he did raise it. He raised it in his at the hearing. He raised it on his BIA brief. And then there, the BIA had a selective reading of the record.
Thank you.
Do you want to reserve the balance of your time?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Your Honor, and may it please the court, Joshua Ha for the Attorney General. Petitioner bears the burden of showing that he is more likely than not to experience torture if removed to Belize. The agency concluded that he failed to meet that burden. Because the record does not compel otherwise, this court should deny the petition. First, this court should deny the petition because the agency reasonably concluded that petitioner failed to demonstrate police acquiescence, which is a necessary element of his CAT claim. For that reason alone, this petition can be denied.
Can you pull the microphone down closer?
Oh, sorry. The petitioner testified that he told the police about the death threat he heard from his sister, and then the police asked for his sister to file a report. When that didn't happen, they didn't investigate further. It is reasonable to look at those series of events and conclude that the reason the police declined to investigate had nothing to do with who the petitioner was accusing or a reluctance to confront gang violence, and everything to do with ordinary common sense protocol. That isn't willful blindness. And the record reflects that the police did not shy away from confronting gang violence, even as to the actors in this very case. The police apprehended petitioner's son numerous times. They had wanted posters out for the alleged hitman, and when petitioner's neighbor was shot, they looked for the shooter. These aren't hallmarks of an acquiescent government.
Well, let me ask you about it, because I mean, you do argue that in your brief that the articles show that the police were willing to arrest and prosecute Mr. Allen and Gorongora and other gang members. And I suppose that could be true, but it seems that they also, or I may ask you, don't they also corroborate Rudan's death threat and demonstrate that Mr. Allen has evaded prosecution for attempted murder twice? And so I guess, shouldn't the agency consider those articles in the first place?
So I do think the agency considered those articles in the first place. The agency said they considered all the evidence in the record, and they were obviously aware that even at the time of the death threat, Allen was in prison.
They seem like they could be potentially very important or dispositive or probative, highly and. So I think the case law is that if it is, then the catch-all phrase saying that it considered all the evidence isn't sufficient. So is there a case you want to point me to, or what's your best argument to counter that?
So I don't have a specific case to point you to, except to say that the case law also has language explaining that the agency doesn't have to name-check every single piece of evidence in the record. And that especially makes sense here, where the record is 1,200 pages long. If you required the IJ or the BIA to describe every single piece of evidence in the record, this would be a substantially longer stronger decision on both fronts. But to go back to what you were asking about earlier, about that some of these prosecutions did not get completed, I don't think that that itself should cause this court to find that the police acquiesced. The best case for that would be Andrade Garcia, which the petitioner cites in their reply brief and discusses it at some length. In Andrade Garcia, the police were investigating the murder of applicant's aunt, but then they left it off at the request of the cousin. I don't see that as a particularly different situation than here, where the victims of the crime would drop their prosecutions or decline to press their charges any further. Petitioner's main argument to the contrary here is that even if petitioner produced his sister to the police, that it's possible that the police still would not have helped him. I don't think the record quite supports that speculation, because again, the record shows that the police were not hesitant about confronting gang violence. Regardless, petitioner has the burden of proof backwards. He has to show that his spin on these facts is the most likely one, not just a merely plausible one. And now that he is before this court, he has to show that the agency's determination that actually they think that the police were willing to help him is just unreasonable, and he cannot satisfy that standard. I also want to go back briefly to your question about how the police might have been unsuccessful in fully prosecuting the parties in this case, not parties in this case, the people in this case. Garcia Millan is clear that general ineffectiveness alone is not enough to establish police acquiescence. I think it says that usually when there is general ineffectiveness, you still have to show corruption or some other inability. And by corruption, it means something like a bribe, for instance, the bribe in Davila versus Barr, or even that the police were acting at the behest of or in cahoots with the gang, such as with Los Zetas in Xochihuahua's Jaimes. I think that's how you distinguish those cases from this one. Here, there's nothing in the record suggesting that the police were taking orders from, or taking bribes from, or were somehow cooperating with the PIV gang. If this court agrees that there is no government acquiescence here, you can deny the petition on that ground alone. Nonetheless, the agency also reasonably determined that petitioner failed to show a likely future torture in Belize. His argument is based on...
Can we talk about past torture just briefly? Sure. Because it looks like petitioner here is arguing that the agency should have considered Mr. Rudon's PTSD diagnosis in its evaluation of whether he experienced past torture. And you didn't respond to this in your answering brief, and so I kind of want to hear what you had to say about that.
So I do think we responded to it in our answering brief, because we discuss on pages 36 to 37 why a single threat. The general rule is that a single unfulfilled threat generally does not amount to past torture, doesn't even usually amount to past persecution, and that this case should track that general rule. We describe how that this case is really a lot like Duran Rodriguez. And Duran Rodriguez was about an unfulfilled past threat. And Duran Rodriguez and the cases it cites are all about the mental effect a threat can have on someone, because that is really the only effect an unfulfilled threat can have, is a mental effect. If there were a physical effect, then it would not be an unfulfilled threat.
Well, I want to unpack that a little bit, because maybe you can point me to where in either the IJ decision or the BIA decision can you figure out that they've actually addressed Dr. Chung's conclusion. You're talking about, well, this is a single threat, but if Dr. Chung's conclusion could be highly probative or dispositive, they would need to mention that. They couldn't hide under the catch-all phrase. But maybe there's somewhere in the decision that I missed, so I'm looking for that reference.
Right. So the IJ decision does discuss when the IJ decision is discussing the Dr. Chung's evidence, which is on page 7 of the IJ decision, he's obviously talking about the effect that that these events had on Mr. Rudone's mental health. And I don't think it's realistic to say that the IJ only considered his mental health his now, I guess, waived argument that mental health alone could constitute a ground for torture when he goes back. It was obviously in his mind when he goes on and talks about the petitioner's fear of torture when he is saying that is not enough. On page 10 to establish a future threat, a future likelihood of torture, which is the relevant inquiry at this point.
You said it was likely in his mind. Whose mind are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry?
When you said it was likely in his mind, whose mind are you talking about?
Oh, I might have misspoke. I was saying that the ultimate inquiry is whether there is a likelihood of future torture. The IJ does talk about his fear of torture right after he already discussed Dr. Chung's evidence on page 7 that these events in this case had an effect on his mental health. But again, I just want to go back that to the idea that the general rule in this court from Duran Rodriguez, and that wasn't a new rule. Duran Rodriguez was citing past cases like Lim, that unfulfilled threats usually are not enough to establish past persecution, which is a lower threshold than past torture. And again, those cases are all about mental health in the end, because that is how a threat alone could constitute torture. And here, that is what it is. It is an unfulfilled threat. And I think the IJ and BIA were well within their rights to consider the fact that that threat was indirect, as meaning that it did not even get to the level of those direct threats in those
other
cases.
Well, this gets to the conundrum. If the threat is not sufficient, you don't have to wait for somebody to be murdered. Then they don't even have a case. So what about in that in-between situation where we have these threats, they're communicated to him because other people have heard the threats? So it seems the government's position is, well, it's indirect and it didn't come to pass. Is that the government's position?
The government's position is that threats alone, unfulfilled threats, generally are not enough to establish past persecution, let alone past torture. And the facts that Your Honor described fall pretty neatly into Duran Rodriguez itself, where the petitioner did receive two direct threats over phone calls from people who were suspected to be sicarios. And ultimately, this court said, perhaps a different IJ could have looked at that evidence and decided, okay, this is a credible threat, and this would cause enough mental anguish that it should rise to the level of past persecution. But the IJ didn't have to reach that conclusion, and therefore it upheld the IJ's determination in that case. The other reason that the direct versus indirect distinction matters, though, is that torture always has to be intentional. So in all those cases where a direct threat can lead to mental anguish, which would itself constitute torture, it's a direct threat where the person knows that they are causing that person mental anguish. I think the Comolari case that opposing counsel cites uses the term deliberately. Like, if you use a threat to deliberately inflict mental anguish, that can constitute torture. I don't think the record really supports that sort of deliberate action here. It's not obvious that the petitioner's son even wanted him to hear this threat. So it's very odd to say that the mental anguish from this threat constitutes torture when no one actually intended in this case to cause him mental anguish.
So the threat was conveyed by his sister, correct?
Yes.
So, and the family circumstances were, should we say, difficult?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if you look at the circumstances surrounding the threat and how it was conveyed to him, you think it was a serious threat?
So there's evidence in the record that could go either way on that. The government points out that he actually stayed in Belize for 6 months longer after the threat was made and nothing seemed to happen. Now, I'm not suggesting that there's a bright line rule there, but the nature of substantial evidence is that two IJs could look at the same record and come to different conclusions. Mm-hmm. The fact that this evidence was filtered through two levels of hearsay, The IJ could also reasonably look at that and determine that, you know, that an indirect threat just might be less menacing than a direct threat. I refer again to Duran-Rodriguez, which says that usually for a threat, an unfulfilled threat alone to constitute.
I mean, it just seems that if one sister were to tell you, hey, your son is determined, you know, is going to kill you, that sounds pretty serious to me.
It could be serious, and but 1208
family related. It, I don't know. It's troubling. Your position is difficult.
I can see that it could be a troubling circumstance, but 1208.18a2 acknowledges that treatment can be inhumane, degrading, and cruel, and still not rise to the level of torture. And I think that IJ was within his rights to determine that it just did not rise to that level. And I think the indirect-direct distinction matters also because in Duna Rodriguez, it says that usually for an unfulfilled threat to rise to the level of past persecution, it has to be, it's usually included with confrontation or other sorts of mistreatment. And that's how you distinguish this case from cases like Cup, Aguilera Cota, or Corpeno Romeno. And again, for many of these cases, opposing counsel repeatedly cites Corpeno Romero. That's an asylum case. That's about past persecution, which is not past torture. It's not the same level.
But of course, those cases don't have the underlying or the backdrop of these two lawless people who've killed a number of people already. And one of them is the son, and there's been this animosity. I mean, this in the texture of this, it's not just, oh, the sister said there was a threat. The sister said there was a threat, and we have all this other evidence in the record, so you've got to take the whole constellation, don't you?
Well, I agree that you have to take the whole constellation, and the IJ did that. And I do want to push back slightly on this idea that Corpeno Romero did not have the same constellation of facts. It might have been even worse. I mean, the direct threat the applicant received in Corpeno Romero was from the same gang who killed his father. You don't actually have that exact same constellation of facts here, and I think that actually weighs against providing relief in this case, as versus Corpeno Romero. I see my time is about to expire. If this court has no further questions, the government rests.
Thank you.
I have 4 points. First, under Zaccheo Jaimes, corruption isn't required to show acquiescence. At 1186, the case clearly says that in that situation, finding acquiescence, the woman testified to multiple instances of such acquiescence in the past involving her personal circumstances. Second point on the threat, at AR 69, the IJ only considered that respondent was never directly threatened by his son. That was the extent of analysis that the IJ gave, which does not mention the PTSD or the circumstances of his son's ability to evade the police. Third point, under torture, the definition of mental pain or suffering under 8 CFR 208.18A4, subsection 4, is that the threat another person will immediately be subjected to death. A death threat, when accompanied by the mental suffering that was established under Dr. Chung's record, meets the very definition of torture. And on the fourth point, Judge Murguia, your prior point that a claim that the BIA considered all evidence is not accepted by this court. Under Cole v. Holder, this court made very clear that indications of misstating the record or failing to mention highly probative or potentially dispositive evidence is enough to remand on that basis. And the pin site is 771-72.
Well, it seems the government here is saying that this was all speculative. It wasn't enough. You're arguing that these articles seem to show that Mr. Allen here has a history of committing violent crimes, has evaded prosecution twice, and has escaped police custody. Also show that this Mr. Gongora, the man that Mr. Rudon claims Allen was hired to kill him, is willing and capable of carrying out that threat and has not been accountable by the police. And so I guess we're trying to figure out here the BIA's reference that it's reviewed everything should include that, but is that enough? And you're saying that that's not enough.
And under Cole, the BIA has to mention it, this potentially dispositive information, which is his record of the named, both his son and the named hitman, regarding their prior attempted murders, and the inability to actually prosecute or punish them. The BIA needs to mention that evidence, and also the BIA needs to mention Dr. Chung's report before determining that this evidence is not enough to show that the death threat is torture, when under the regulations and under the record, it most certainly is.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the oral argument presentation here today. The case of Rudon versus Blanche is submitted. Thank you, Ms. Hong. Thank you, Mr. Ha. Appreciate it.